the advent of Parshas Mishpatim, the narrative sections of the Torah are put on hold until further notice, and we are introduced. No sooner have we had Matan Torah, Ma'amad Har Sinai, Marishoni Misinai, Afeilu Misinai, Ve'eila HaMishpatim. And as we know, the Parsha of Mishpatim opens, the first of the sections is that of Eved Ivri. Ki Sikne Eved Ivri, if one acquires Eved Ivri, Sheishonim Yavod, he works for 6 years. Uvashvi'is Yetzei Lachavshi Chinam, and in the seventh year, he goes out free. And many Meforshim, each one in their own way, are wondering, what is it about Eved Ivri, of all of the Mishpatim, that it was chosen by the Torah to open Parshas Mishpatim? And the question, as we've noted in the past, is accentuated. Not merely are we asking, Manishtana ha-Mishpat hazeh mikol ha-Mishpatim, that it could have been any of the Mishpatim, of all of the equal candidates, why was this one chosen? It seems a counterintuitive choice, for a simple reason. The classic case of Eved Ivri is a person who stole and cannot pay back, which means that he has already violated another of the Mishpatim. That means that Eved Ivri is by definition the middle of a story. It has been preceded by other Mishpatim. At the very least, for the Torah to say, Ve'eila HaMishpatim, don't steal, if a person steals, he pays back double. If he can't pay, then he becomes an Eved Ivri, and Kisikne Eved Ivri, etc., and so forth. And that really is the full, that's the tip of the spear of the question of why the Torah has chosen to open with Eved Ivri. And there are many approaches to this question, of course. Zeh Omer Bako, Vezeh Omer Bako. And I believe a most fascinating answer to this question will be reached when we move back in Chumash Shemos to Parshas Va'era. In the beginning of Parshas Va'era, Perek Vav, Pasuk Yud Gimel. It's one of the psukim that are in the, shall we say, build-up section of the Parsha. Makkos haven't started, and sometimes it doesn't get the attention due to it. Perek Vav, Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe ve'el Aharon. Hashem spoke to Moshe and Aharon. Vayitzaveim el Bnei Yisrael. Ve'el Paro Melech Mitzrayim. He commanded them to the Bnei Yisrael. He sent them to Bnei Yisrael and to Paro. Lehotzi es Bnei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim. Now, the Pasuk is actually a little bit vague. It's a little open-ended because he commanded them with the goal of leaving Mitzrayim, but he commanded Moshe and Aaron to the Bnei Yisrael and to Paro. What are they meant to do? What are they meant to say? What is the issue at hand? The Pasuk doesn't really specify. That's why Rashi says he commanded them to give Bnei Yisrael the respect due to them, and also Paro, the respect due to him. He is the king. There is a Yerushalmi in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, in Perek Gimel Halacha Hey, as the Yerushalmi goes. And the Yerushalmi says, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe ve'el Aharon, Vayitzaveim b'nei Yisrael, he commanded them to the B'nei Yisrael. Al Matzivam, what's the command? What's the message? Says the Yerushalmi, Al Parshas Shiluach Avodim. He commanded them on that occasion regarding the mitzvah of Shiluach Avodim. As if to say, part of what is happening as the Jewish people are being prepared for Yetzias Mitzrayim, it's a year yet in the making. This is yet before the Makos, but nonetheless, a message is being sent to Bnei Yisrael. When you have Avodim, be sure to set them free in the appropriate time. Vayitzaveim el bnei Yisrael. And as the Mefarshim point out, in this respect, the Jewish people are exactly like Paro, in the sense that they are both being given the same message. Each one, of course, in a very different context. But the message is the same. The moral of the story is the same. The message to Paro is, let my people go. When? Now. The message to the Jewish people is, let my people go. That is to say, when the time comes, and Alpi Din Torah, you have to let them go, be sure to let them go. This is the very same message. It's refracted differently within the context of the Jewish experience. But it's the same thing. And what's interesting to note is, what is the significance of this timing? That the Jewish people at that time are being told that when, should you have people who are indemnified to you, who are serving you to pay off debts or whatever it is may be sure to let them go when the time comes. What is the significance of that being said now? Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, in the Sichos Musar, explains that the truth is, not that we have that much experience in this per se, but if a person has an eved, then to let them go is not a simple thing. It's easy to say. But that's the type of life you can get used to. The eved lives in the house, he works for you, 6 years, comes Rosh Hashanah, Shana Tova, and all the best. And that's it. It's not so easy. A person has a sense of possessiveness with regards to things that they used to own, certainly. And therefore, literally, with Hadlokas Neiros on Rosh Hashanah of the 7th year, he's out. It's not so easy. The Mefarshim tell us that very often mitzvahs are introduced to the Jewish people at a time where they are in a frame that they are most receptive to the concept of that mitzvah. When they are in a situation that they will be able to relate to the theme of the mitzvah, so that it can be instilled, quote unquote, into their national consciousness, and thus maximize the insinuation into their behavior. There is no time the Jewish people appreciate what it means to be an eved and then to go free than the time that they went free. That's the time to talk about this. Feels good? It's nice to go free. It will be nice for your eved to go free also. Remember. And therefore the timing was of the essence. If you spoke about it even a week later or a month later, we've already forgotten. So there is what's called the Shas HaKosher. One has to strike while the oilam is hot. But there is more. And interestingly, just to brings to mind Me'inyan Le'inyan. Mara, 2 weeks ago, when the Jewish people are given certain key mitzvahs, sham samlo, choku mishpat, v'sham nisohu, they're given a sampling, so to speak, of the mitzvahs. And amongst them, of course, the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach given to them again, and Shabbos, all these things are vitally important, and Parah Adumah. Parah Adumah. It's not going to be relevant for a while. They can't perform it until they have a Mishkan. It's got to be Shechted Pesach Ohel Moed. And for all the other reasons that there couldn't be a Parah Adumah. But why is the timing of Parah Adumah, of all things, it seems to be the less expected choice within that select group? Says Rabbi Shua Le Diskin, because Parah Adumah is a mystery. It's an enigma. It doesn't make sense. It's metame those who are metaher those who are metame. It just works backwards. It goes in conflicting directions. Difficult to relate to. The time to talk about it is in Mara. Because the Jewish people had water that was undrinkable, and it was rendered drinkable by wood that was itself poisonous. And therefore, when you have something which the effect is the counterintuitive to what you would expect it, and they drink the benefits, now it's time to talk about Parah Adumah. Davar be'ito matov. But there is a further point. Not only is it a timely matter, not only is it pertinent to that time, but the Yerushalmi goes on to say, "Va'asya kahi de Amar Rabbi Hila," and this fits in very well with what Rabbi Hila said, "Lo ne'enshu Yisrael ela al parshas shiluach avodim." The punishment of the Jewish people for their golus was indeed over being remiss in the area of shiluach avodim. That is to say, and the basis of all of this is a chapter in the Navi Yirmiyahu. It's actually the Haftarah for Parshas Mishpatim, although we don't always read it. This year, for example, it's already Parshas Shkalim, and therefore, until further notice, we don't have the Haftarah for Parshas Mishpatim. Not this year. But the Haftarah is from Yirmiyah, and it's chosen for this reason, because it begins with a reference to Shiluach Avodim. And these are the words of the Haftarah. It's Haftarah Lishma, because we won't be learning it in Shul. Komar Hashem Elokei Yisrael, Anochi Karati Bris Es Avoseichem, I cut a covenant with your forefathers, Biyom Hotzi'io Same Eret Mitzrayim, Mi Beis Avadim Neymor. On the day that I took them out of Mitzrayim, I said to them, Miketz Sheva Shanim Tishalchu Ish Es Achiv Ha'ivri, Ashe Yimacher Lecha, Vavad Choshe Shanim, Vishilachto Chavshi Me'imach. That's black on white. That's the Navi Yirmiyahu says, when they took you out of Mitzrayim, I told you, when the time comes for your ever to go free, send him free. So that's really, certainly we have the information now that it was said. The Yerushalmi says that's the pshat in the pasuk in Parshas Va'era. But what's interesting is this injunction to send away the Eved Ivri when the time comes is called Krisas Bris. Krisas Bris is a covenant. It's a deal. There are two sides and there are terms and conditions. And what the Yerushalmi is telling us is that the terms and conditions of Geula for the Jewish people, that's the bris. I'm taking you out of Golos, and you need to respect the freedom of your own Avodim. A bris means the conditions need to be met, and if they're not, the bris is nullified. And that's why the Yerushalmi says that ultimately when the Jewish people were remiss in granting freedom to their Avodim, they were reluctant to let them go and wanted to hold on to them. So they forfeited their own Geula state and were precipitated into Golos. And that's the Midah Keneged Midah. If they do not respect the rights to freedom, Al Pi Torah, when the time comes, of their own, then their situation is also in jeopardy. So the mitzvah of Shiluach Avodim has now been propelled, one could say. It is no longer, quote-unquote, another of the Tariq mitzvahs. It is a key to a geula state of the Jewish people. And moreover, says Rabbi Shur Diskin, what to my mind is a great chiddush. How does the parsha begin? We're used to it, so we don't notice it. It's the parsha of Eved Ivri. What's an Eved Ivri? A Hebrew slave. Says Rabbi Shur Lev Diskin, the Jewish people are not really accustomed to being called Hebrews by the Torah. The Torah calls them Bnei Yisrael. It doesn't call them Ivrim. Your brother, Yisrael, is not an Ivri. And this Eved is called an Eved Ivri. When are we called Ivrim? Says Rabbi Shur Lev Diskin, in Mitzrayim, we're called Ivrim. Komar Hashem Elokei HaIvrim. And so on and so forth. The Yerushalmi told us, and corroborated by the Pasuk in Yirmiyahu, that the Parsha of Shiluach Avodim was said in Mitzrayim. Imagine. When it was said in Mitzrayim, the appellation and terminology was of that time. The reference would have been to, and when you have an Eved Ivri, because the Jewish people at that time are referred to as Ivris. Ivrim. And therefore, it is possible, says Mariel Diskin, that what's unusual about the Nusach here, about the the way that he's referred to is because the original nusach of the tzivui was kept on. And thus we have a reference to Eved Ivri in Parshas Mishpatim, because the mitzvah was given while they were yet referred to as Ivrim. That's a chiddush. And I was wondering, perhaps, that if we say that indeed we have at least the basic formula of a mitzvah that was given much earlier on, that is to say a year earlier, yet in Mitzrayim, and now it's given again in Parshas Mishpatim, and it is formally now one of Tariq Mitzvahs, and it's in the Torah, the text of the Torah. Is there anything that's been added on? Often, when the Parsha is said again at the time of Matan Torah, perhaps there are aspects that were not applicable originally that are applicable now. The Mitzvah of Mila was given to Avraham Avinu, but the notion that Bris Mila overrides Shabbos was not given to Avraham Avinu because Avraham Avinu didn't have a Mitzvah of Shabbos. So as Mila comes back and is again stated within the context of Har Sinai, there will be further halachas about it as it reaches its final formulation, its Sinai formulation. The notion of sending an Eved free after 6 years was already said in Mitzrayim. Is there anything added? I don't know categorically, but I do have a feeling. And it's based on the fact that, as the Pasuk tells us, let's say the Eved doesn't want to go out. V'imamor yomar ha'Eved, ahavti esaduni, es ishti v'esbanai, lo etzei chavti, I don't want to go out. So he stays. But while he stays, something else happens. The Pasuk says, v'higisho adunov el ho'elohim, v'higisho ladeles ola mezuzah, he doesn't just stay. He gets a certain mark. V'ratza adunov esasno b'martzeya, his ear is pierced with the awl, b'avado la'olam. Why is his ear? Why is there a hole put in his ear? Well, as we know, Rashi quotes from Chazal. Ozen zo sheshoma al har Sinai lo tignov. He heard in Har Sinai not to steal. You went and stole. There's got to be a comeuppance for that. Why it happens when he stays and not originally is another discussion. But the origins, or at the very least the background to the din of Ritzia, of putting this hole in his ear, is because this is the ear that heard at Har Sinai lo tignov. When the mitzvah was given to Bnei Yisrael in Mitzrayim, no one had heard anything at Har Sinai yet. Could it be that this aspect of Eved Nirtza, of Ritzia Sa'ozen, for example, is something that is applicable once the Bnei Yisrael have heard the Torah, which was not in the original mitzvah when it was yet given, the prehistoric mitzvah, so to speak, at Yetzias Mitzrayim. And perhaps there are other things as well. That's a very interesting question to ponder. At the very least, acharei hadvarim ha'eleh, we certainly have a new angle to understand why it is that the Torah opened Parshas Mishpatim with Eved Ivri. Is it the first mishpat that one would encounter? No. But it's the first mishpat that we encounter. Historically, it's the first mishpat we ever received. And therefore, it is presented first. In spite of the fact that it's in the middle of a story, etc. and so forth. This was our very first mishpat. In fact, if we could borrow a phrase from later in the Torah, Lo mishpat ha-bechoro. This was the very first mishpat, and therefore it is the first mishpat of Parshas Mishpatim. Moving on from the first mishpat of Eved Ivri, we come to altercations, Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, and in terms of restitution, the Pasuk says, Pasuk Yudches, Perek Kaf Aleph Pasuk Yudches, V'chiyirivun anoshim, if people are fighting, scuffling, v'hiko ishes re'ehu be'evan over egra, if one strikes the other, v'lo yamus, and he doesn't die, which would lead to a whole different dynamic altogether, v'nafal le'mishkav, but he falls ill, he's incapacitated. Im yakum v'salech b'chutz al mishanto, v'nikoha makeh, so if he gets up, so then the one who hit him is cleared at least of murder because he recovered, but he's got to now make restitution. Rak shivto yiten v'rapo yirape. But he has to make restitution for shivto, sheves. That means this person could be out of work for a while. You have to pay for the work you would have done, on however that's rated. V'rapo yirape, and you have to pay for his medical bills as well. And these are two of the famous five areas of payment for restitution: nezek, tzar, ripui, sheves, and boshes, as the Gemara discusses in the 8th Perek of Baba Kama at length. What I would like to focus on is a most fascinating comment that is made to be found in the Gemara in Baba Kama, Daf Pei Hei Omid Aleph, in the name of Rabbi Yishmael, on the words v'rapo yirapei. And whenever we see these double expressions, of course, we are on guard. He shall surely heal. He shall indeed heal. What does this mean? V'rapo yirapei. Says Rabbi Yishmael, Mikan shenitna reshus larofe l'rapos. V'rapo yirapei means the Torah says, you see, you are allowed to heal. Permission has been given to the doctor to heal. Nitna reshus larofe l'rapos. That's very interesting, because the question immediately, of course, is, what if the Torah hadn't told me that I have permission? What would I think? That I have no permission? Would I wait for permission until I move in to heal? Why do I need permission? Why would I think that it would be incorrect for the doctor to heal? And Rashi comments. And Rashi says, amazingly, that perhaps one would have thought that way. If the patient is sick, and where does the sickness come from? If God has brought sickness upon him, so maybe I should stay out of the way. Should I interfere with God's business? God has made him sick for a reason. I hope he gets the message. But in the meanwhile, should I interfere? Should I undo God's work? If God made him sick for a reason, I could be ruining things by healing him. And so on and so forth. I could be getting in the way. That's interesting. Says the Torah, heal him. You're a doctor. Don't worry about God's business. Worry about your business. If he's sick, heal him. It's interesting, actually, that Rashi explains this way, because the background of the psukim, as we saw, is someone who's fallen sick because his friend beat him. It's interesting, if within context, Rashi would say that one would still say, well, if God has seen fit to strike him down, God didn't see fit to strike him down, the guy next to him saw fit to strike him down. Does that mean that that's also considered min ha-shamayim? Or do we say that it's extra contextual, and for cases where relevant, that he really developed a disease not because of someone else's actions, one would have thought not to interfere? But it's actually a good question, as if to say, okay, we know it's not true, but why is it not true? What is the approach here? So the Rashba explains, very simply, because the issue here is interfering with God's will. God's will is now expressed to you that you should heal him. Because the state that HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts a person in doesn't always mean that he doesn't want that person to do anything about it. After all, says the Rashba in the Tshuvas, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu made someone poor, what will we say? Maybe I shouldn't help him. Maybe he's poor for a reason. Maybe I'm interfering. I'm abstracting God's plans. He's meant to be poor. That's a philosophy that is so anti-Torah that it's exactly the same thing. Maybe if he's sick, maybe he's meant to be sick and I shouldn't interfere. No. And certainly the poor person himself, in addition to davening for Parnosa, etc., but he should also send out his CV. And therefore we have the golden merging of hishtadlus on the one hand, that a person is meant to do what they act responsibly to further their interest, with an understanding that HaKadosh Baruch Hu needs to bless it in order for the endeavor to be successful. As it is for Parnosa, so it is for Refuah. It is certainly true, says the Rashba, that as one goes to a doctor, and this is something that perhaps is easy to forget at the time, but it's very crucial. According to the Rashba, as one goes to a doctor, a person needs to approach a doctor with bitachon in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that he will send bracha and send refuah. And this is the indictment of Asa HaMelech, who when he was sick, the Pasuk says in Divrei Hayomim, Beis, Perek Tet Zayin, the Gam Becholyo, when he was sick, says the Pasuk, Lo Darash Vashem, Ki Barofim. He didn't seek out Hashem. He only sought out the doctor, says the Rashba. That's illegal. Only to seek out the doctor? No. You need to seek out both. But Lo Darash Hashem, Ki Im Barofim, so then that is an indictment of the patient. But all of this, of course, is in terms of the patient. That is his approach. The doctor cannot make his treatment conditional upon the patient recognizing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one behind all of this. He needs to treat the patient regardless. So this is Rashi's very interesting explanation of the Torah giving Rishus. Don't think you're interfering. You're corroborating. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from you. If you have the power to heal, you should use it. The Ramban has a different explanation of why the doctor needed Rishus to engage. And these words are taken from the Sefer Torah Sa'adam, which is the Sefer of the Ramban about many medical matters and beyond. And he says, Perush, why does a person need Rishus, a doctor, to engage? Shema Yoma Harofer, because perhaps the doctor will say, Ma li hatsar hazeh? Why should I take on this potential distress? Shema ete. Maybe I'll make a mistake. V'nimtzesi horeg nefashos b'shogeg. If there is a treatment whereby if it goes wrong, the patient's life could end, and I'm the one behind the treatment, I hope it goes right, but maybe it would go wrong. So maybe, what do I need it for? And maybe it's wrong for me to take that chance. Lefichach nosna lo Torah rishus lerapos. That's what the Torah gave you rishus. As if to say, of course, we're talking about a qualified physician. We're talking about a person who knows what he's doing. There can always be a risk factor. But the fact that there's a risk does not mean that it is wrong for this person to engage if they are doing so with the full knowledge and responsibility of what it entails. And thus the Torah says, Verapo yirape, rishus you have. Now, so far we've spoken about the doctor's role entirely in terms of, does he have permission to heal? One would have thought, no, for either one of the two reasons. And the Torah says, yes, you have permission to heal. What's interesting is, the Rambam, when he discusses the issues of doctors and healing, he doesn't speak about whether they have permission. He actually goes to the other extreme. The Rambam, in his Perush on the Mishnah, Maseches Nedarim, Perek Dalet, says that for a doctor to heal is a mitzvah. He doesn't speak about permission. He speaks about mitzvahs. Now, when we use the term mitzvah, of course, we immediately need to ask, which mitzvah? I mean, there's 630 mitzvahs. Which one is it? And the answer happens to be Hashavas Aveda. The concept of Hashavas Aveda is to return to something, to someone, something that they've lost, or something that they are in danger of losing. Now, what type of thing are we speaking about? Well, of course, naturally we intuit objects. His sheep, or his shoes, or whatever. But the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Ayin Gimel, tells us that the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda applies as much to preventing a person from losing their health as it is preventing them from losing their sheep. Right? Their health is their primary possession. It's their primary asset. To help a person either regain their health or prevent them from losing is Hashavas Aveda. That's one of the Tariq mitzvahs. What's interesting is how these two are synthesized, because the Gemara speaks about Rishus for the doctor, and the Rambam said it's a mitzvah. Well, why is he talking, it seems, in cross purposes than the Gemara? But the Taz explains in Yeridea that because one would have thought it's wrong to get involved, we need the Torah to say it's not wrong. You have permission. As soon as you have permission, it is instantly a mitzvah. Because if there's no obstruction, it is clearly then Hashavas Aveda and becomes, of course, a mitzvah. It's most interesting to note, in this regard, a third perush of the Torah giving rishus to the doctor. Again, our question was, why does he need rishus? If a Jew couldn't become a doctor, I mean, many fundamentals have been severely threatened here. Why does he need rishus? Rashi gave his explanation, Ramban gave his explanation, and one of the Baalei HaTosfos, Rabbeinu Yaakov Meorleans, explains, in his opinion, the doctor doesn't need rishus to heal. If he can help, he needs to help. So why does the Torah need to give him rishus? Apropos of our discussion, the mitzvah of healing is Hashavas Aveda. So let us ask a question. If a doctor heals, can he take a salary? Well, yes, of course. If a person performs the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda, can he take a salary? No. The most he can do is some form of compensation for the work that he lost. But if this is his job, returning people's lost property, that's a mitzvah. You can't demand a salary for a mitzvah. But have we not just said that healing people is a mitzvah? It's Hashavas Aveda. So the intuition is that a doctor should not be able to demand a salary for performing that mitzvah. Says the Torah, Verapo Yirapeh. He's allowed to heal as a doctor, incorporating, receiving a salary. That's why the Torah needs to give him rishus. It needs him to give him rishus to function as a doctor, to be compensated as a doctor, with a salary. But why is it true? Why is it acceptable? Says the Podim Yofer, Sir Pinchas Halevi Horowitz, because the Gemara tells us that it's very important for a doctor to receive a salary. In the eighth parak of Hachova, which says that you need to take care of the medical side, if someone has damaged someone else, he needs to take care of healing, to pay for his medical bills. Says the Gemara, what happens if the person who beat him also happens to be a doctor? I mean, when he's not beating people, he's a doctor. And therefore he says, if we count off the areas that I owe you, damage, I will pay. Sheves, I will pay. Ripui, you're in luck. I'm a doctor. I'll heal you. So of course, we should not be surprised to hear that his victim is entitled to forego becoming his patient. But what if he says, okay, I'm not going to pay you, but I do have friends who are doctors, and they'll do it for free. So I'm not going to pay your medical bills if you go to someone else, because I have a doctor who's just as competent, and he won't charge you. And I demand that you go to him. Says the Gemara, the victim does not need to accept. Why not? Says the Gemara, because a doctor who doesn't charge for what he's doing is not worth the money that he isn't taking. That is to say, if it's done a favor, one can't afford to have anything less than the full incentive. It's a very serious business. And therefore, you're entitled to say, I don't want your friend the doctor to treat me for free. I want you to pay for a doctor because I want to be treated by a doctor who's being paid. Ad kedei kach. And therefore, says the Hafla, that is what's behind the Torah gives rishus to receive a salary as well. When he's operating on a very delicate matter, he can't be mulling over his student loans and the like. He's got to have his mind completely on the task at hand, and it becomes unique because it's a mitzvah that he's paid for. Because that's a hidur mitzvah. He'll do the job correctly. Now, with regards to the concept of refuah, it's very interesting to note that there are numbers of refuahs that are mentioned actually in the Gemara as one goes through, here and there, Maseches Shabbos and Maseches Gittin and in a number of places. And the question arises, of course, if one follows the Daf Yomi, one hits them periodically, and the question is how to relate to this. Of course, we relate to everything in the Gemara deadly seriously. It's the Gemara. What exactly are, how are we to understand what these refuahs are about? Now, the perspective that I am presenting, I do not say it's the only perspective, but it is sourced in very, very heavyweight personalities of the Gaonim, Rav Sharira Gaon and Rav Hai Gaon, and others. And they say, and it needs to be understood well, that when it comes to matters of medicine, in the Gemara, says Rav Shirira Gaon, the remedies that are to be found in the Gemara are not received from Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't receive them from Sinai. The Gemara gives one a guide to living. 99% of Torah living is Torah, that is to say, keeping Torah and mitzvahs. But a person also needs to stay healthy, and if they're sick, they need to get better, etc. The remedies in the Gemara, says Rav Shirira Gaon, were culled from what was considered to be the best of medical knowledge of that time. And that principle remains the same. That is to say, the medical advice that one follows needs to be drawn from the best of medical knowledge at the time. When it comes, of course, to Torah and mitzvahs, that's Torah and mitzvahs. With regards to these refuahs, so there, they consulted with the doctors that they knew, and this is what they were told. But things do move on, and they continue to move on. Even in our times, medicine still evolves and develops. I have an uncle who's a cardiologist, and he's been in the field for decades already. And he said that if he were to apply today methods and procedures that were considered to be the only way to do things 40 years ago, he'd be convicted. That would be a criminal act, because things have moved on. At the time, that was the best they knew. And now, of course, they know much better, and hopefully better and better still. There was a sefer which was written about matters of refuah, and he mentioned this idea of Rav Shirira Gaon, and he said the refuahs in the Gemara are not necessarily from Torah, from Sinai. They are taken from the doctors of the time. And he brought this sefer to Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach to review. And Rav Shlomo Zalman had a comment about that and said that when you write this, write Yesh Omrim. There are some who say. So the author says, does that mean there are those who argue, who say that they are Torah Misinai? So Rav Shlomo Zalman says, I haven't seen anyone who says otherwise. But it's a weighty enough issue that if you've only seen two or three people, as great as they may be, say one way, it is more appropriate and more accurate to say Yesh Omrim. You'll say what they said, you'll say what needs to be said, without making the presumption that there is no one who argues. Because as far as many other Rishonim, we just don't know. That is the way to say it. And of course, this was so often true, and Shlomo Zalman showed the way in many respects with regards to this, that what to say and how to say it are two separate disciplines, and the second is often no less important than the first. And so it is that we may and will find that we are advised not necessarily to partake of the refuahs as they are to be found in the Gemara. Times change, medical knowledge develops, climate changes, people change, etc. and so forth. The Gemara tells us in Maseches Moed Katan, Daf Yud Aleph Amud Aleph, that the best time, the healthiest time to eat fish is just before it goes rotten. When it reaches just that point. And they tried it. That is to say, it was from experience. The constitution and whatever else, what was going on in the diet, it was known to be very healthy for them. Tosfos, on the side of the Gemara Moed Katan, comments and says, do not do this. Do not try this. Because times have changed. And it's at your own risk. In our experience, if it's just about to go rotten, it's one step away from going rotten. Don't expect it to do good things for you. The Rambam in Hilchos Deos, where he mentions many aspects of healthy living, does not refer to the refuahs in the Gemara. He doesn't codify them, he doesn't mention them, and the Lecha Mishnah and others explain that really the Rambam is corroborating the same point, there is one constant mitzvah: take care of yourself. V'nishmarta me'od l'nafshoseichem. How? Consult your local doctor. In the Gemara, that's what they did. The Rambam was the local doctor, and therefore he wrote the way medicine saw things in his time. By the same token, we do not necessarily follow everything that the Rambam says. with regards to matters of refuah, because things have moved on once again. And in fact, the Marshal in the Yamshel Shlomo in Maseches Chulin in the 8th Perek quotes a cherim hakadmonim. There was a cherim that was put on a person who would irresponsibly try out the refuahs of the Gemara, because he wouldn't know what he was doing. He'd harm himself and then say, and what has the Gemara done to me? The Gemara didn't specify amounts. These were things that were known, quantities, proportions, and the like, and therefore these are matters that are not necessarily for current consumption. So that's a very interesting discussion with regards to verapo yirape and the Gemara in terms of refuah itself. A final point, which is actually a central pillar of Parshas Mishpatim, is the well-known acharei rabim lahatos. When it comes to a dispute, and there are many, and this matter is put to the Beis Din, one follows the majority. That's in Perek Kaf Gimel, Pasuk Beis. Now, how does it work practically? Well, there are Mishnayos about this in Maseches Sanhedrin, how they would discuss and how they would put it to the vote, and however the majority decides, acharei rabim lahatos. You're never going to ever get everyone to agree on everything, and you don't need to. Whatever the robes say, that's what we follow. But how exactly it works, what is the understanding behind following the majority, on that we will see there are two fundamentally different ways of looking at it. There are two groups who argued with each other consistently. The famous Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. And as we know, the halacha is like Beis Hillel. And the question is why? Why do we follow Beis Hillel? The answer is quite surprising, if you've never heard it. And that is to be found in the Gemara in Maseches Eruvin, which says that they were locked in dispute. And at a certain point, a baskal came out. A voice from heaven which said, the halacha is like Beis Hillel. Eilu ve'eilu divrei Elokim chayim, it's all part of Torah, and halacha lemaisa is like Beis Hillel. Now, we have a problem. In our experience, that's not an acceptable way to solve a discussion. We are aware of the well-known case of Rabbi Eliezer against all the other Chachamim in Maseches Bava Metzia and Daf Nun Tes, and he was arguing with them, and they were arguing back, and no, neither side was giving in, and then Rabbi Eliezer called in a baskol, and Rabbi Yeshua responded with the famous Lo Bashamayim, Ein Mashichim Babaskol, we don't pay attention to baskol. And the halacha is not like Rabbi Eliezer. So whatever the baskol meant, it's not part of the halacha. So we should be surprised and somewhat disorientated to find out that we paskin like Beis Hillel, which we do the whole time, is based on a baskol. I thought we didn't listen to baskols. So why do we listen to this one? And the Tosfos discuss this, and the Tosfos say the reason why we listen to this baskol, the paskin like Beis Hillel, is because Beis Hillel were actually the majority. There were many more of them than there were of Beis Shammai. See, Rabbi Eliezer, he was the minority. He was one person. He tried to bring in the baskol, but if he's the minority, we're not going to follow him. But Beis Hillel is the majority, and therefore, that's why we listen to the baskol, which says to follow Beis Hillel. Now, we should still be stuck for a simple reason. It turns out that we don't listen to the baskol unless the situation is such that we would have listened to it even had there been no baskol. As if to say, if Beis Hillel were not the majority, we wouldn't listen to the baskol. But they are the majority. But if they're the majority, then why do we need the baskol? So it's either unacceptable or redundant. But there's nothing in between. So the question still remains, what exactly is the baskol doing? We're only going to listen to it if we would have followed that course anyway. Because Beis Hillel are the row. And this is a question that has spawned a great deal of discussion. But I would like to refer to the comments of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. And he asked, arguably the most fundamental question about Sanhedrin and a fundamental question about halacha. The Sanhedrin, their job is to decide halacha. What does that mean? What are they looking to do? Well, there are two possible answers to that question. Ultimately, the meta question is, the pre-question is there an absolute right answer to the halacha? And there's only one answer that is really correct. The job of the Sanhedrin is to find that answer. When the Sanhedrin have been in session and they've come to their conclusions, the Torah says follow their verdict because they are the most eligible and most likely to have arrived at the correct answer. You're not going to do it. These are the most qualified people. You've got to do something. And they have the most likelihood of getting to the correct answer and therefore rely on that. There is another possibility, and that is the very definition of halacha is whatever the greatest minds of, or the chachamim, the consensus of the chachamim of that generation, whatever they decide, that is the halacha. As if to say, by definition, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm telling you to follow the Sanhedrin because whatever the Sanhedrin say, that's what I want you to do. By definition. It could be in absolute terms, their conclusion is not the absolutely correct conclusion. Could it be? But nonetheless, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in terms of living Torah, wants the people of each generation to follow the conclusions of the Sanhedrin of their generations. Which means by definition, it's right. It's not that they're more likely to have gotten it right. What defines right for them is what they decided. It is self-defining. As long as they have been honest, rigorous, they are the most, they are qualified chachamim. That is what halacha is. And there are implications from this question. First and foremost, it will affect the way we look at the Torah's injunction to follow the majority. When there's a dispute, some say one way, some say the other way. But whatever the majority says, that's the Torah says, Acher Rav Nahatos, follow that. Why? Why do we follow the majority and not the minority? Maybe we should follow the minority. There's two possibilities. If we understand that we're always looking, by definition, success will only be defined ultimately as finding the right answer. And there is only one right answer. So when the Torah says follow the majority, it's because although two opinions have been put forward, the majority are more likely to have anticipated the correct answer more than the minority. Could it be the minority is right? It could be, but the majority are more likely to be right, and you can't do nothing. But according to the second understanding of what halacha is, by definition, the verdict of the Sanhedrin defines the halacha, then the majority is followed in pure terms. Whatever the majority said is the halacha. Of course, that's what you should follow. It's a very different vision of what it means to follow the rove. And then, the follow-up question is as like this. Imagine that the Sanhedrin had an opportunity to access heaven's opinion on a certain matter. If they could. Most times they can't. When the Torah says, Acher Rav Nahatos, is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm not going to reveal myself and tell you the answer to everything. You've got to work it out. But let's say you were able to get the answer in a particular occasion. How would we relate to that possibility? Well, that will depend on how you understand what halacha is. If halacha is an absolute, that is to say, there is one right answer, and you're looking to find it, you do your best. But if you had a way of, on occasion, of finding out what it actually is, that would be a wonderful opportunity. You would certainly take it. Whereas, if you define halacha as the decision of the Sanhedrin, so whatever Shamayim has to say is by definition, irrelevant to the halachic process. And you wouldn't pay any attention to it at all. It would be interesting to find out whether your views coincided with that of Shamayim, but no more than interesting. Now, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, it seems, because Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, they argued the whole time. But there's an underlying argument. See, they never really resolved their mafloksim. There's an underlying argument. Namely, they are disputing the nature of halacha. It's the bedrock of their disputes. According to Beis Shammai, there is one truth. There is only one right answer. And they felt that they had it. According to Beis Hillel, whatever the consensus of the Chachmei Hador determine, that is the halacha. The reason why things got more complicated than usual is because the Gemara tells us in Maseches Yevamos at the end of the first perek that Beis Shammai were known to be sharper than Beis Hillel. There were less of them, but they were sharper. And the reason why is because Beis Shammai were much more selective in terms of those that they would take as Talmidim. Beis Hillel had a much broader net. Beis Shammai, you needed to be qualified even to be a Talmud. This would later play itself out in the famous episode of Rabbi Gamliel, who put a shomer at the door to inspect whoever could be a Talmud. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah got rid of the shomer and called Dich ben Yosef Yechol. Anyone who wanted to come in and learn, they could learn. It was Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai again. And in the words of the Gemara in Yevamos, Mechadidei Tvei Chadudim, Beis Shammai were sharper. It was known, and Beis Hillel presumably conceded that. Now, if that's true, so the question is, the consensus of the Chachamim of the generation, there are many more of Beis Hillel than there were of Beis Shammai. So, shall we apply the principle of following the majority? Says Rabbi Yaakov, that was part of the machlokas as to whether it was relevant here. Because under normal circumstances, if all things being equal, if the majority are on an equal footing intellectually in Chochmah to the minority, then we assume that they got the right answer. But in this case, you had a disproportionate representation of Chochmah within the minority, whereby they felt that the fact that there's more Beis Hillel doesn't mean they're more likely to have gotten the answer right. Whereas Beis Hillel subscribed to the understanding that halacha is defined by the consensus of the majority of Chachmei Hador. They were Chachmei Hador. Which means that they held certainly that the halacha should be like them. And so, when in doubt, follow the majority. Unless the majority is part of the imbroglio, it itself is being disputed as to whether you can follow the majority. So how can you proceed? The answer was a very unusual situation. The Baskel came out. Why would a Baskel come out? Because the only thing that was preventing Beis Shammai from following the majority, Beis Hillel, who were in the majority, is the fact that they felt that they had the absolute truth with them, and the fact that Beis Hillel are in the majority doesn't alter that. So nothing Beis Hillel could do could sway them. But a Baskel could. Because the Baskel is now putting them in a situation whereby either way they will need to go like Beis Hillel. If it's because Beis Hillel is a rove, now they may discount that, but if they discount that, it's because they need to find the answer. Heaven gave them the answer. Follow Beis Hillel. And thus you have a unique situation in the history of halacha, really, of halachic disputes, that a Baskol came out. When we move back to Rabbi Eliezer, it's most interesting to consider that Rabbi Eliezer called for a Baskol, and nobody else really accepted it. But Rabbi Eliezer was a Talmud of Beis Shammai. Rabbi Eliezer is Shamusi, and therefore it could be that he yet preserved the paradigm whereby if I'm stuck and no one's agreeing with me, I can enlist a Baskel. Because he's from Beis Shammai, and that's how they related to these disputes, whereas Rabbi Yeshua, of course, is a Talmud of Beis Hillel, as were the other Chachamim, and therefore they were able to say in Mashiach and Baskel. So these are very thought-provoking comments from Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, and they touch on fundamental questions with regards to Parshas Mishpatim and Halacha beyond. We'll leave it over there for a few.
The last part you just said.